Ryan Stanton here with ASEP Frontline, joined today by Dr. Jason Adler, and we are, this is actually one that's going to be huge for everybody, a huge player, live once again here at Emerald Coast Conference, which interestingly a year ago was our first live conference after the COVID pandemic, which wasn't after the COVID pandemic, it was just in one of the breaks of the COVID pandemic. Hopefully that's not the same for this year, but we're talking about the way that our documentation is going to be changing. A quantum shift in the way, and as right before we got started, and Dr. Adler mentioned that you may have actually gotten it right, and I think there are some very important pearls and things that I think are of value, especially to young physicians and folks out there, considerations of things outside just the tick-tocks of the heart and the breathe in out of the lungs. So Dr. Adler, give us a little background on yourself and how you got into this.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan, for the introduction, and I appreciate being here. I started off with a private democratic independent group, and in that, after residency, became pretty involved with documentation and to a lesser extent, reimbursement. And what I found was it's really complicated, but at the same time, it doesn't have to be. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't have to be. So I got into that space more and more over time, and I really found my passion and my niche, and I enjoy talking about it, and I do it in a way, my approach is not to focus on the outcome of finances, just talking about what I care about, and I think most of our audience cares about in medicine, is just high quality patient care. We want to be at the bedside. We definitely do not want to be at the EMR. We don't want to be at the EMR, and we want to avoid some risk, right? We don't need to do things that add additional risk, and unfortunately, today we're going to talk a little bit about the 95 guidelines and some future changes moving towards the future of next year. The tectonic plates are shifting, and we will have a massive change next year. And as we make that transition, it makes more sense than it had in the past. But thinking back to what the 95 guidelines did to us and what became normalized, we have so much note bloat. So I think my central message is there's a way to write a chart that makes sense, that gets us at the bedside, keeps us away from the EMR, reduces our risk, and if you just focus on that, the finances will take care of themselves, and we don't even have to talk about them.
And that's what I feel like we've been for so long, is even looking at notes now, it just feels like it's a giant file cabinet just of extraneous data. That's great for billing people, but it's terrible in terms of continuity for me reviewing old notes, for looking at what's there. I mean, even now searching back and looking at notes from another facility, you know, you're going through 50 different pages of medications and visits and diagnostic codes and all these different things just to find the one paragraph that you're looking for that explains what the hell's going on with this person and what we've been managing and evaluating. And I mean, when I was going through medical school and residency, it was always the VA notes that were that way, the cut and the paste, everything that was there, were they exposed to Agent Orange, all these different things that were in there. They were necessary for them from an administrative standpoint, but not really helping me at the bedside. And then with the evolution to the EMR, transitioning from T-sheets, which were incredibly simple to the point of being too simple, to the point of now with these EMRs that just dump everything in there, and you know your least favorite phrase that a patient gives you, well, it's in my chart. Which might as well be, well, it's a needle in a barn of haystacks. Let's talk about some of that bloat, that the overall gluttony of these charts that are out there, and how these changes will impact the need for that just volume of chart versus the quality of chart.
Yeah, it's a great question, and you hit the nail on the head, because historically, the 95 guidelines were a big deal. When they first were introduced, we're offered this huge set of rules. And around that same time, the EMRs started doing more what we call auto imports, bringing in that information. And then because the guidelines required so much bean counting, right? You had these review systems that became elongated. You mentioned T-sheets, which are really nice for billing, but doesn't really offer, in some cases, a context, right?
Very little narrative.
Yeah, the HPI a well-written HPI is so valuable, right? But if you're just checking off timing, onset, duration, character, intensity, you're not really creating a story that means something for the future, you're just counting points. And that's what is likely to change as we move towards next year. The first major change, and full disclosure, the official guidelines have not been released for us in emergency medicine. They have not been released. But there were major changes in 2021 for the outpatient sector, which provides a nice template that we have a pretty good understanding and can anticipate at least the bulk of what's going to change next year. So the biggest change, the first change that I would offer is the history in the exam will no longer be used to level the chart. Just marinate on that for a moment. No longer, and by level, I'm talking about assigning a financial value to the services rendered, which is a huge shift from 4 HPI elements for level 5, 10 review systems for level 5. The HPI, the review of systems, past family social history, the whole history section and the exam section will not be scored for financial purposes. And in the exam sections, we know have a ton of bloat, right? We talk about doing psych exams on most patients who may not have a psychiatric complaint or component or may not really need that. Or we talk about normocephalic atraumatic in an adult, normocephalic. It's created itself because of these 95 guidelines, but as we move forward, if that part goes away, that will be a huge change in the way that we address our documentation and really focus on the patients in front of us and exactly what are we asking questions for. Yeah.
And that's, you know, and that so much of the education now, and it's going to be a lot of transition because and one of the biggest challenges we're expecting, at least from the talk I heard yesterday from Dr. Peralt, was that we're expecting some of these released in sometime around September with expectation that January 1 we're going active. So it's going to be a huge up ramp to get people transitioned. And of course, leading the horse to water doesn't mean they're going to drink. You know, getting our physicians and other healthcare professionals to buy in and see that change of the difference in the way we write notes to where we're on and say, okay, this chest pain, where is the chest pain? What's the character of the chest pain? What makes it better? What makes it worse? What are the other contributing factors? What are the other symptoms? And everything that we go into and really being able to focus on really exactly almost where it should be, which is actually telling the patient's story in the HPI of saying, well, why are you here? And then exam-wise, being able to focus specifically on what we're needing to look at. So just as you mentioned there, and unfortunately where we see so often that really gets in that fraud care category is that clicking of boxes within the EMR. And it's like, wait a second, I don't know that we really did check a rectal on a person who came in for a sore throat. And if you did, then we've got bigger problems that border on assault. But, you know, just the whole idea of getting into that clicking boxes, but being able to focus on exactly where things are. So we're moving from that being the focus, the HPI, so the history, the ROS, the exam, as much. What are we actually looking at now?
So now the whole story is going to be about medical decision making, and that could be really complicated, but we can.
But it's good because that's actually what our job is.
Think about that, right? Yeah, we're getting it right now. And when I approach this and look at the guidelines on the outpatient side, anticipate what to look for in the future, we can really brush this into just one little bucket here. It's called the 4 Ds of medical decision making. The 4 Ds. It's what is your differential? What are you doing? Who are you discussing it with? And what are your determinants? And by determinants, I'm talking about social determinants of health, which is a huge pivot compared to the 95 guidelines, really focusing on health equity and things that matter to us and our patients.
Well, and the thing that are going to increase the risk to our patient, or and vice versa, with actually adding some weight to those things that are going to be challenging. So it's whether it's food insecurity, housing insecurity, you know, those things. When we drain an abscess, draining an abscess on somebody who's got, you know, their own home, you know, great clean municipal water, private insurance is very different from somebody who lives in an encampment somewhere, who doesn't have running water, who doesn't have who's sleeping on an old mattress, you know, those types of things. And we know that. We take that into account. Can they even get the medication that we're trying to prescribe for them? So we're trying to treat hypertension in somebody that was relatively easy but doesn't have access to medications or funds. You know, how do they get those medications? You know, thinking about that things of how do we actually make our patients better?
Let's talk about social determinants of health for a moment and health equity. So we're talking about declaring it on the diagnosis line. That's most commonly how it works. But if I were to say to a group of ER physicians, when you hear ICD-10, what's the first thing you think of? And most commonly, I would think the answer would be billing. But it's not well known that ICD-10, that code set, is actually trademarked by the World Health Organization. In fact, the I of ICD-10 is international. The intent is for epidemiologic tracking of illness and disease. Ryan, can you think of a time in the last 2 years that there was value in epidemiologic tracking of illness? So most of the COVID data that we look at comes from claims forms. It comes through that ICD-10 code set. There was actually a mid-cycle addition for COVID coding multiple times over the last 2 years.
You actually saw it going. You saw first three or five of them going, and then all of a sudden, this voluminous expansion of COVID-related diagnoses.
And it was very atypical, but we needed it, right? The world needed it, thinking internationally. So the ICD code set is focused on epidemiologic tracking of illness and disease. Let's shift for a moment to talk about social determinants of health. If you've ever given a patient antibiotics to go, or if you order a nebulizer, or rather an albuterol inhaler, and then say you keep the puffer, there might be a reason for that. And I think you've articulated well that we see social determinants of health every single day in our departments, right? And as emergency medicine, we are there for the patients, all patients, 24/7, 365. That's what we do. It's the nation's healthcare safety net. So what I would offer is, by capturing social determinants of health, what we're really doing is creating an accounting system to show the work that we're doing every day. And you really articulated it well. There's risk involved. It adds risk and complexity to the care we provide. And when you add risk and complexity by showing those social determinants of health, you capture it on the diagnosis line. And it's not the primary diagnosis, it's layer down, lower down there. But what you're really doing, at least the way I see it, is you're creating an accounting system to show what you as a clinician are doing for that one patient. And then that goes through the department, goes through the hospital, all the way to the state. In fact, if we have a better accounting system, this could shape state policy and funding towards Medicaid programs. Mm-hmm. In fact, if multiple states do it, you're talking about shifting national policy. This goes so far beyond the billing or the coding or the reimbursement for one chart. It is on the risk table on that chart level, but for me, the story is much, much bigger.
This sounds better, because it really is. So often you see, especially in the diagnostics, you have one line, cough or whatever, and it always just frustrates everything, because to me, the diagnoses are whatever the reason they were there, your diagnosis, primary impression, and then anything that contributed that you used to play into it or may impact the outcomes or the decisions you made. So you've got right now we've got a ton of viral syndromes going around, viral syndrome, then you have diabetes too with hyperglycemia, then you have hypertension, elevated blood pressure with hypertension, and then on top of that you're going to throw tobacco use, and on top of that you may, whatever else it may be that's on there. And that's, one of those key education points is there's rarely, unless it's a five, there's rarely going to be a single diagnosis unless there's purely nothing else to go in there, but should have all of that stuff in there. And that really, it sounds like we're going to get more value in truly telling that story of what we saw, the decisions we made, why we made them, and the things that are going to impact this patient's outcomes.
Totally agree. And I think there's a huge opportunity for us as a community to understand the value of the diagnosis line and to really have a conversation about how to show the work that we're doing in a meaningful way. And I would do it in the spirit of accounting and data aggregation. So let's just say, for example, you see a young, healthy patient that comes in with palpitations. That's their, what we call the presenting problem, chief complaint, depending on if you're on the billing side or the hospital side. Maybe you do a tox screen, you do an EKG, you look for PERC, or maybe a dimer, right? There's a differential. Mm-hmm. Maybe check thyroids. There's a process there. If your final diagnosis is panic attack, that's all that's visible to the world, because everything in the actual chart sort of lives within the EMR in its way, but what goes outward is that diagnosis line. So leaving it alone as panic attack, change that and swap it out to something like palpitations, acute tachycardia, history of OCP use, active nicotine use, right? When you read that, you've really declared the risk stratification, the complexity of the care, and everything that you're doing as you assess that patient in a way that has a better accounting tool than just panic attack or just shortness of breath. It's more of the story we talk about with chest pain and patients putting the heart score on there. You've got chest pain of unknown etiology, history of diabetes, active nicotine use, abnormal EKG. That comes across differently as just chest pain, mm-hmm. whether it be related to reimbursement, but really for accounting and for capturing the data.
Well, that's one thing you mentioned before we got to talking was this shift from where the EMRs were before you used that, the the example from Moneyball, but is the whole idea that we had this whole focus that the chart was about capturing finances and making sure you get the maximum level, whereas now we're a little bit more of a shift, and that will be the end result, you know, eventually. But really, it is more about focusing on the work that you did as a physician and not just checking boxes for the data that you've put in there that may not be germane to what you're actually thinking. You know, for me, for the description of chest pain, it's not really that important to me. I mean, it really is that patient in front of me, what I'm seeing, what I'm experiencing, you know, kind of the picture and that risk assessment that I do in my head, you know, assistance with the heart score and things as well. But, you know, it really is more of that global picture. And so kind of talk about that little bit of that change, especially in some of the billing aspects of it, of saying, let's actually focus on the care and let the rest take care of itself.
Yeah, so let's do the medical decision making, and then I can add some commentary about the diagnosis line, because they are two separate pieces here. So based on what we know about the 2023 guidelines for emergency medicine that are going to ramp up on January 1, and you said it earlier, you're totally right. In 1994, before the 95 guidelines were released, there were many months of very clear descriptive guidelines presented to everybody, and once they turned on, there was a grace period where people weren't always held that accountable, and then it turned on shortly thereafter. In our current state, and we've been living with them for 27 years, mm-hmm. 27 years, we've been living with the same set of rules. Now we're gonna find out, we'll say September, it might be a little bit before, it might be a little bit after, and then it's just on January 1, and we gotta figure this out really quickly. So the best practice advice I would offer, so we already got history and exam, no longer scored. Now we got the four D's of medical decision making. We talked a little bit about social determinants of health and how that affects the accounting, and that relates to the diagnosis line. But more importantly, that will affect the risk scoring on these guidelines, which is a good thing. Let's go to the differential. And we talk about bloat and risk. I think everyone, at least once in their career, at one of the EMRs they've worked with, you, me, you've seen these dot phrases like dot, ED, abdominal pain, male. And it shoots out like 40 things that you're not always looking at or investigating. To me, that just adds length, bloat, and risk. It doesn't offer anything for anybody. Now, there's some arguments with the billing and health, but let's move past that. I think there is value in offering a differential, describing a differential as it relates to your workup, as it relates to your workup. And doing so really gives you a clear way to show how you, what your rationale is for including or excluding your diagnoses. But it's targeted and focused, more narrow, less bloat, on what you are doing. And then you could layer in comorbidities. Just think of a patient who comes in, a 30-year-old patient with non-traumatic low back pain. You have a differential for that, and you're gonna perform or not perform diagnostic studies based on that differential. Take that same patient, now layer in comorbidities related to maybe they have a history of HIV, maybe there's a social determinant of health with lacking adequate housing and resources. Maybe they have a social history of IV drug abuse. Completely different patient than the first, right? With a completely different differential. So you would want to document a differential and workup based on the presenting problem. This is really basic stuff, but I'm just emphasizing to create a targeted differential that focuses on the workup that you're performing, and that's D1. So D2 talks about what you're actively doing. What are you doing? And I think there's, you know, in our modern day, in our workflows, I'm sure we've all been there. You sit at the workstation, mm-hmm. right? Someone drops an EKG on your desk. You're looking at labs from a patient. Maybe you're in another chart. There's an overhead page. Dr. X, pick up the phone. Another EKG comes on. Someone asks you a question. The patient in this room over here wants to talk to you. There is so much parallel processing that we go through every single day, and that contributes to burnout. The distractions are troublesome. But while all this is happening, we are and we do want to make a coherent medical record. And when I focus on D2, what are you doing? It's really documenting the subconscious things that we're doing, mm-hmm. but that matter towards the patient and their care. For example, I think about secondary complaints. If the chief complaint is chest pain, but there's a secondary complaint of something else, we want to get that in the chart to show what we're doing for it. And something as simple as electrolyte abnormalities you're addressing, right? Or something as simple as addressing abnormal vital signs. What are you doing? You're addressing those abnormal vital signs. Patient comes in tachycardic over time. We want to make sure that that gets resolved. It's a huge risk reduction, right? We don't want to be discharging people with abnormal vital signs. We know the risk involved with that. So I spend a lot of time talking about the subconscious work that we're doing and really just thinking in ink and getting it out on paper. A simple example would be alcohol intoxication, which we don't know in some cases, but someone comes in with altered mental status. We'll perform a CT to rule out ICH, CT neck, because they're not nexus negative, right? We gotta get a CT head and neck. Labs reviewed, magnesium, potassium are low, will be repleted to avoid arrhythmia. Vital signs, initially tachycardic, have responded to fluids, now heart rate 180. And what you've done there is you've declared your differential about ICH, you've declared that you're concerned about a cervical fracture, you're addressing electrolytes, and you've stabilized in vital signs. There may be an opportunity to amplify those electrolyte and secondary complaints and vital signs in the chart to make a more linear record to show the work that we're doing and the value that we offer, because we're doing that every day. The reassessments matter. That's part of every single day. That's D2 for what are you doing. We went through D1 is your differential, D2 is what are you doing, D3 is what are your discussions. And this is really interesting. This is really interesting. I'm sure you have gone to a patient's room to say, I want to update you on your lab results.
Absolutely.
And they've said to you, I know them. They're on my cell phone.
Oh, my chart now. Oh my gosh.
Right?
Or the fact they call you in there to ask about them before you've even seen them.
There you go. So patients are reading the charts. I think a lot of people read these charts. These are legal documents that have a lot of purposes, transmitting information to other clinicians. You have coders and auditors, quality, stroke, sepsis. These charts live forever. Mm-hmm. Patients go. And we want to make a well-written chart without spending too much time there with the intent that it can withstand the test of time. So when it comes to discussions, I really think about patients and I think about risk. So if a patient is sent in from an urgent care or from their private physician documenting the patient was sent in, and here's the intent there, right? Sometimes they call in, say, I'm concerned about this. I'm sending this patient in with asymptomatic hypertension, just to let you know, as an example. But when they send that patient in, you want to document that is the reason that they're there today. That offers value, right? That offers medical necessity, and that could help the hospitals, but it also shows where the information is coming from and helps fill out the work that's being done. I think if EMS gives you information, that's valuable as well. Old record review, if I think we all do this. There's these long narratives in the MDM section that will say, you know, patient comes in with heart failure, last EF was this, and then you talk about what they came in with and go through this whole narrative. But in that one paragraph, you'll have old record review, communication from EMS. The absence of attributing it to where you got it from can cause problems down the road because it could be problematic in the sense that we want to be really thoughtful and purposeful about getting and attributing the information that comes from non-patient sources, being really clear and deliberate about that information and attributing it to them. And that, I think, just makes a medical record that people can understand and read. Old record reviewed, comma, last echo showed EF 15%. Will not give 30 cc per kilo bolus for sepsis, or severe sepsis septic shock.
Right.
That shows I got it from this, and now I'm gonna act on there. It's part of our workflow and the decisions that we make. Same thing with the EMS conversations. If the note says that the patient was found down, unresponsive in the woods, and the patient doesn't remember that way, I think saying that that's what EMS told you is more clear than just saying you making that declaration yourself. And it does come into play with the new guidelines. It was in the old guidelines as well. And I think it reduces risk and really just makes a more coherent record. So that's D3. For discussions. It's old record review, discussions with consultants, which we all know what is said to whom and when, what information was included.
Unless it's infectious disease, who always says, don't put my name on the chart.
Yeah, we get that, right?
Yes.
But attributing that offers value. So the discussion point, it's really an outside historian declaring that for who it is and what was said makes a better, well-written chart. I think we should be doing that anyway. Reduces risk, reduces bloat, and also will help the scoring. And then the third or fourth D are the determinants. And we've already kind of talked about that, but I want to add one more piece of information comparing 95 to 2023. I don't know if everyone knows this, but in 95, on the risk side of scoring on those coding guidelines was a section that awarded high-risk points for giving an IV-controlled substance. Mm-hmm. Let that sink in for a minute. We were credited and benefited from giving IV-controlled substances. I think about DopeSick, right? That has not aged well today.
No.
I don't want to be involved with that. It feels icky, right? And I think this is a good move moving towards 2023, because now the pivot goes from administration of IV-controlled substance all the way to social determinants of health, which feels good, creates that accounting, and really shows the amazing work that your whole audience does, our community does, every single day.
Well, and it doesn't. It allows us and gives credit for that extra effort, extra work that goes into it. You know, that person who's living at the shelter, you mentioned the albuterol, you know, have somebody comes in, whether it's asthma, COPD, whatever it is, and you provide those medications, whether it's the prescriptions from there, or whether you give them the albuterol inhaler and let them keep it, knowing that it's going to be very difficult for them to get one as an outpatient. You know, that extra work, that extra effort is now getting some of that credit. So, you know, as we wrap today, kind of give us this global thought of 95 to 2023. I mean, you mentioned, and I was going to bring up anyway, the IV controlled substances from 95, getting credit for that, just like when, you know, pain scores with the Joint Commission, as well as with the evaluations, and none of that stuff has aged well. The whole idea of everybody deserves to be pain-free has not aged well at all. But looking at this transition and what it means, as you mentioned before we started, you know, they may have actually gotten it right. And it, of course, it's not going to be perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but it sounds like we're getting to a point that it's a significant improvement that really focuses on the physician and our patients and the discussions, thoughts, and mental bandwidth that goes into that patient's care.
Yeah, so I appreciate the opportunity to be here. For me, the story is about the 95 guidelines were presented a very long time ago. They have not, I agree with you, that's something I keep saying over and over. They just have not aged well. And we've been trapped in this box, and the EMR industry has really blown up with these auto imports. There's bloat, I'm concerned about risk. I think there's an opportunity though, right? There's always a silver lining, and we are emergency medicine. We make lemonade more than any other specialty on earth. We have the fewest resources, and we do an amazing job. And as we transition to next year, I think the silver lining is, what I see the opportunity is to not get trapped into this heavy bean counting top part of the chart that takes a ton of time, adds another piece of bandwidth consumed with the EKGs and the phone calls and the distractions, de-emphasizing that, and really does emphasize and amplify the cognitive work and the medical decision making in the medical decision-making section, but it's the cognitive work, the intensity, the decision-making that we're making, that really matters contemporaneous to patient care. We want high-quality, low-cost care with good outcomes, right? That's really basic. And we wear the Emtala badge on our sleeve, we love it all, but I think the new guidelines are more appropriate and aligned with the medicine that we practice today, and that should make us all feel good.
I completely agree. How can, and of course, I look forward to getting back with you and hopefully at Scientific Assembly in San Francisco, because there should be information available by then. I'm sure you'll have a lot of information, discussions, talks once we actually have some more defined points of what's actually going to be involved for January 1st, as all of our companies will be in full panic alert trying to transition the way we do it now and reset that mindset to where we are going. And I think for a lot of physicians out there, it's probably not going to be a huge transition, because you do a significant amount of discussion within narrative within the medical decision making, but for others, that's typically pretty bare. That this may be a little bit more of a transition. How can folks get in touch with you if they have any questions, further information, also to keep tabs with how things change over the next 6 to 8 months?
I appreciate that. So, Jason Adler, University of Maryland School of Medicine. I work at their residency program in Baltimore, Maryland. My email address is jason.adler, A-D-L-E-R, at SOM, School of Medicine, .umaryland.edu. Happy to answer any questions the audience has. And I look forward to working with our community to be more focused on making charts that make sense without living in the medical practice.
Well, I appreciate it, and I know that one of the transition points here is coming from Maryland, being down here in Destin with the Emerald Coast Conference, will be shedding the suit jacket. I learned that very quickly coming to this conference about 12 to 15 years ago. I came in a suit the first day and realized how humid and hot it gets here. Actually, this week it's going to be pretty incredible. But I enjoyed having you here, and thank you for your time and joining me here on the front line, and look forward to catching up later this year.
Thank you very much.
As for me, you can contact me, rstanton@asep.org, rstanton@asep.org, or at EverydayMed on Twitter. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASEP Frontline.
If you're not on the front lines, you're on the sidelines.